Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Cancer is a far-reaching, often devastating illness that touches everyone, either directly or indirectly. Oftentimes, navigating grief and loss can be complicated and confusing, especially for children. In this surprisingly uplifting episode, you'll hear from a very special guest about her personal experience living through cancer at the age of 18, how the experience enabled her to gain a unique perspective on the effects of cancer on families, and actionable ways teachers can support children affected by the disease. Through her positive storytelling approach, you'll learn 7 specific needs that well children, specifically siblings, require in order to develop resilience in the face of familial cancer. This is such an important episode. I hope that you learn as much as I did. Genevieve Stonebridge is a clinical counselor at Inspire Health as well as Rise Health. She is devoted to creating safe and inspiring places for people to explore their experiences. This includes holding space for both the suffering and the joys of life. With compassion, creativity, and openness, she believes in meeting patients wherever they are at. She is passionate about helping people explore their relationships with themselves, their loved ones, and their bodies. Her research thesis, entitled You Matter, Retrospectively Exploring the Needs of Adolescents Who Had a Sibling with Cancer, developed into a short film called You Matter. You Matter succinctly summarizes her research in a digestible way for the general public and was accepted to premiere at the 2015 Boston International Kids Film Festival. For more information, check out Siblings You Matter on squarespace.com. Genevieve lives in Victoria with her husband. She loves good quotes, gardening, dinner parties, random acts of kindness, and pondering the meaning of life on the bluffs of Dallas Road. For more information about Genevieve and her amazing work, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search for episode 26. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. The Small Act, Big Impact Kindness Challenge and the podcast is really rooted in creating cultures that are safe and supportive in schools and really value the individual. So I know that as a cancer survivor and a registered clinical counselor, you've dedicated yourself to creating safe and inspiring places for people to explore their experiences. So through your work, you've been able to hold space for both the suffering and the joys of life. I'd like to start within the context of your own story. Can you speak to your experience as a survivor of cancer and how it's informed your work and life as an adult?
Absolutely. So when I was 18 years old, the September after I graduated grade 12 of high school, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is cancer in my lymph nodes. And I went through the sort of typical styles of treatment, radiation, chemotherapy, and a whole bunch of other things I did to support myself at that time, and was fortunate enough to come away from that experience. Now here we are 17 years later, and I'm a happy, healthy, thriving 34-year-old, and have learned a lot about what it means to be a mortal human being, and having I've learned a lot about also the language around cancer, which I think, knowing you, Morgan, I think you'd appreciate. But one of the things I've learned through my research and through just the work I've done around working with cancer patients, and also having been one myself, is actually using the word having lived through cancer, just because of the word survivor and sort of interesting discussions that have come up with people around what that word means to them and what it means to people who do not live through a cancer experience. So one of the things I usually try, even though it's kind of more cumbersome because it's a lot of words, but just describing that I'm somebody who is fortunate to have lived through a cancer experience. And so through my journey, Dance with Cancer, as an 18-year-old and coming out the other side, I went through a lot of different adventures, obviously, as a young person, trying to figure out what the heck I'm doing on this planet and how do I want to give back. It's something that my family really instilled in me, is, you know, how do we give and be of service to others. And so through lots of different schooling and personal growth adventures, I found that I had a real passion to understand how a cancer diagnosis impacts people, and everybody's obviously impacted differently. I did my undergraduate degree in psychology, and as I was doing my undergraduate degree in psychology, I decided that I wanted to go towards a master's of either art therapy or counseling psychology. So I started taking lots of art courses, theater courses, creative writing courses, and what I often would focus on is actually trying to make sense of my cancer experience, because I had come out of the cancer experience, fortunately, like with a really loving family who had talked a lot about emotions and stuff, and I'd made sense of it. But there was still some part of me that was really, I think I was wrestling with what that means to be aware of the fact that I was mortal and my health was, I don't want to say fragile because that makes me maybe sound I don't know. I don't use the word fragile, but it's something that I really try not to take for granted. So I really explored my cancer experience through printmaking, and through, I created a theater project through Applied Theater, and we interviewed a lot of different cancer survivors, and then created a show in which we brought together all of their stories to help portray what it's like to go through cancer. I wrote a short piece, which was a homage to my lymph nodes. And anyways, just all these different ways of trying to understand what it means to face my mortality. And then through that, was fortunate enough to finish my undergraduate degree and then roll into a really exciting job working for the Canadian Cancer Society's oncology summer camp for kids called Camp Good Times. And at Camp Good Times, they have really wonderful summer programs for families in which the child who's diagnosed with cancer, as well as their parents, as well as their siblings, get to come to camp, get to be with other kids who have cancer. And that was in 2010. And at the time, I was 26, just about to turn 27. And I had actually not really been in a cancer population with a bunch of people who were walking a similar path and seeing each other in it. Because when I was treated for cancer, I was treated in the Kelowna Hospital with adults as opposed to in the Children's Hospital. And that was a good decision because it was, you know, got to stay close to home and stuff. But I was young and there was nobody my own age around. Like the closest person at that time, I was offered to speak to somebody else who had a similar cancer, and they were, you know, a young dad in their 30s, which when you're 18, you think that's old.
Absolutely. And don't we think a little bit differently now?
Yeah, oh, wow. I'm so young.
Wow. So that must have been, I just think about you and sort of seeing the difference between this experience of children who are experiencing a similar difficulty or challenge and being supported by the comfort of one another and that common experience, but you didn't get to have that. So that must have been at times very difficult, because I can imagine that it must have left you feeling lonely and as though, because of this difference, that it was hard to belong at times.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those things that I didn't realize I had missed until I saw The incredible feeling of undoing aloneness that happened for these kids. So it was actually like, it was interesting. I think because I had at that point, it was 8 years later. It was like a really, something we call sometimes in therapy, it was like a corrective emotional experience. So it was some part of myself that I actually didn't know that I was hungry for. But then as I saw these kids being with other kids and going like, hey, I'm not alone. You're bald. I'm bald. Hey, you're dealing. You got these ports. I got these ports. You've had, you know, something amputated. I've had something amputated. And it was like, they were not alone. And so actually it wasn't sad for me. It was actually really helpful for me. And it felt like this really big full circle of making sense of what the experience had been like for me. And then getting to be of service to give back to these kiddos. And also, so the other really like really important piece for me was recognizing the impact of what was happening for the siblings as well. And that was like a really big aha for me, because at that point, I was 26 and my younger sister was 21. And it just sort of, it hit me like a ton of bricks. One day I was facilitating a support group for, the parents, and they were talking, one of those groups that one of the parents had just brought up, like thinking about the child who, well, for sake of ease, we just call the well child. So the child who's undiagnosed with cancer. And obviously there are varying degrees of wellness and illness, but, it started to sink in for me. And I, all of a sudden, I remember having this moment of, oh my goodness, Jazzy. So my little sister, Jazzy, and I just hadn't really considered how she was impacted by cancer until that point. It's interesting because even just saying that still makes me weepy. And I've done all kinds of, you know, it's always, I think, going to pull up my heartstrings.
Yes.
Of that moment of recognizing like, oh, Jazzy.
Yes. And I've watched that video and I'll definitely put a link to it and we'll speak more to it, I hope. The video that accompanied your master's thesis, which really spoke to the needs, the seven needs, I believe, of well siblings in terms of how can we support them through that experience. And yes, there were moments in that video hearing the stories of the siblings and how confusing and difficult and all the range of emotion and even the shame that was built into some of that, and some mostly self-inflicted, but it's sort of this situation where there is no roadmap. Our culture doesn't really embrace and openly talk about grief, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this, when you're diagnosed or when you have someone in your family diagnosed with what could be a terminal illness, that it does bring up all of these issues and this sense of mortality. And with that sense of loss. And without the roadmap, especially as a child, all sorts of stories play out. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, that's exactly what comes up is the facing of mortality. Because I think it's changing. And I actually recently was sitting with somebody who's saying, you know, things have changed from, you know, even 10 years ago when you'd hear the word cancer. We know that there's many kinds of cancers that are thankfully curable, or at least you can live with them for a good period of time. They don't all mean death. Mm. However, unfortunately, we do that. That's honestly, when most people hear the word cancer, we equate it with the word death. And we live in a death phobic society. And I think that what that means is that we don't really know how to hold space and just hold space for conversations around the uncomfortable emotions that accompany that. So you were speaking to some of the feelings that came up for the siblings in my study. And I'm just going to backpedal us a tiny bit just to how I got to that study. So it was from my experience of working at Camp Good Times, making the connection of, oh my goodness, my little sister was really impacted by this. And then one of the nurses who I worked with at Camp Good Times was also really passionate about how when one sibling is sick, what happens to the sibling. And this is actually, you know, this is research that can be extrapolated to many different, illnesses, however you want to define illnesses. Mm-hmm. And that's what many people have said to me is like, yeah, this could be the siblings of a cancer patient. This could be the siblings of a child with autism. This could be siblings with a child with mental illness, anxiety, whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's what people are noticing is a commonality and thread to that of just making sure we pay attention to all members of the family when there's something difficult going on. Mm-hmm. So So in grad school, as you were mentioning about the program, or pardon me, the thesis that I did and the research study that I did, I focused on the needs of adolescent siblings when their sibling is diagnosed with cancer. And so my sister became sort of the key informant for the research study. She was not one of my participants, though she is in the video, because mm-hmm. not all my research participants wanted to be in the video, understandably. Some of them wanted to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed 7 siblings and just asked them, you know, really just tell me the story of what it was like to be you when your sibling was diagnosed with cancer. And that is a really critical piece of thinking about that, you know, sort of unidentified person in this diagnosis and asking them, who are you in this? Mm. And I think that that's a really key piece, you know, in thinking about how teachers, friends, family members can support a family who's going through cancer is just thinking about all the players in this. How is the child who's diagnosed? How are they really doing? How are the parents really doing? And if there's other siblings in the house, how are they really doing? And what do they need in this? And, you know, you were making reference to the piece around some of the uncomfortable feelings mm-hmm. that came up for those siblings. And that's, you know, that is, I would say, if I can have a favorite theme from my thesis, it was that was my favorite theme is, you know, the need for siblings to know that it's normal to have uncomfortable thoughts and or think of like difficult feelings and uncomfortable thoughts or something along those lines. But really, like, because what happened and Jazzy really beautifully articulates it was like she was really mad at me because she didn't understand what was going on fully. She was a little bit more introverted. Things weren't getting super explained to her. She also wasn't asking a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the really big things for her was she didn't get this chemo, which is supposed to make you feel better. Why the heck was I so sick? Mm. And so there was this sort of disconnect for her and a bit of anger, right? Like she had previously been the littlest one of the family who had probably a little bit more attention put upon her. And then all the attention was put upon me. Mm. And she didn't fully understand what was going on. So she shares pretty openly that, you know, she was mad and it came from a place of not understanding and wondering, you know, is she faking it? But then like the most painful part, and before, you know, any of us judge Jazzy, it's just, you know, it comes from this place of not knowing. Mm-hmm. But the really painful part for her was that she then would feel that emotion and then be like, oh my gosh, like, how could I feel that way? What a bad person I am for mm-hmm. feeling that way. And then, you know, not share any of those feelings. And so end up just feeling bad on top of bad, right? She's already feeling yes. kind of mad and sad and left out, but then judging herself on top of that of, well, only bad people feel this way.
That's right. And that whole idea that shame brings about this feeling of unworthiness and this feeling that you are unworthy of that belonging piece and that there must be something wrong with you. And who do you think you are to even feel this way? Like, it seems as though with all of that comes this shame and this fear. And then with it also comes the silence. And without being able to share that story in a safe space or with even adults or people who can hear what she's saying without punishing her for it or to hear that without, and mm-hmm. this applies again to any sibling, that's a difficult thing. So that must have been a heavy burden on her for a long time and for siblings in that type of a situation. What would you say are some of the negative results of this dynamic for those well siblings?
I think it's mostly that piece that would be like of the findings from my research study would just be that they gave themselves a pretty hard time. And so Jazzy, I mean, she wasn't one of my research participants, but she was, you know, just a voice among many of the other voices who spoke a similar story of, you know, being really angry at their sibling, but then being like, oh my God, I'm such a bleh,
yeah.
you know, for feeling that way. And so, what the research and the literature points to is, you know, sometimes it can lead to siblings, perhaps acting out in different ways, becoming, more isolated or engaging in other peer groups and things like that. Looking for attention in other ways and engaging maybe in riskier behaviors and things like that. So you know, the importance of the need for social support, particularly like just thinking about, you know, in your realm and context, mm-hmm. from school-based individuals like teachers and even classmates and things like that is actually really imperative. And that's what my research study showed. But then a lot of the other previous literature pointed to was ways to keep them engaged and let them know. So even if they're having a hard time, that they still matter. And it was quite like with two of my research participants, it was like quite interesting to notice a contrast in two sibling stories. One of them spoke about that they had this volleyball coach who was really like knew exactly what was going on. The family was pretty connected to the school. And there had been like discussions in the classroom where the well sibling was really a part of it. Mm. And they would go and they'd be with their sibling for treatment, but then they would come back in the classroom. People would help keep them up with homework. Their coaches made exceptions so they could still be on the volleyball team. Like they were sort of, it just sounded like they were so held and they'd had this really positive experience with school. Mm. And then there was another sibling who had a completely different experience. They just felt pretty forgotten. And they, you know, they did drop out of their extracurricular activities. No exceptions were made for them as they explained it. And they ended up really struggling and feeling pretty unseen by both their family and both their community. There wasn't really a lot of people looking out for them, taking their hand and saying, hey, how do we help you through this? Right. How do we keep you involved? And that's, you know, going back to the whole piece around guilt or shame. And I really like how Brené Brown describes guilt is, you know, ooh, I did something bad and I feel bad about that. Mm-hmm. And shame is I did something bad. I am now a bad person.
Right.
And so this one in particular sibling just described like her immense feelings of guilt for what was happening for their sick sibling and feeling, you know, guilty, like, oh goodness, like they were aware of the ways in which that their quote unquote, let's say, you know, acting out behavior was impacting and stressful for the family, but they didn't really know what else to do. So it was like the guilt in, you know, sort of compounded upon guilt and ended up in a lot of feelings of shame. And, you know, who knows if that could have been mitigated by some, you know, caring individuals, and maybe mm-hmm. people did, but their real story was that they had felt pretty forgotten and that there weren't people stepping in and really asking them what did they need and how could they be supported through this really difficult time.
Absolutely. And I think that's the piece that I'd like listeners to come away with is, so if you are to give advice to a coach or to a teacher, to a principal, even to a peer classmate or a family member, how can we hold space for someone who is experiencing this effect of sort of the well sibling feeling forgotten? Because I think quite often what happens in these types of situations is people don't know how to act. And so they'll yeah. often sort of default to a silent approach. If I don't say anything, then I'm safe and then I don't offend anyone. So that can actually be mm-hmm. just as damaging as saying something wrong. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I empathize with that. I don't know about you, but like, mm-hmm. I have years of training of this and life experiences. And there's still some times where I feel like, oh crumbs, what's the right thing to say here? And I think like that, you know, lends to your other theme of having kindness for ourselves, that there is no right, perfect words. Mm-hmm. And sort of letting ourselves off the hook for that and just trying to find how we can lead with our heart and lead with, you know, some invitation of care is better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think really, really, really crucial, important piece is not believing that it's our job to fix anything. We're not going to, right? That's not our job. And I don't really believe anybody needs fixing. People need love. People need support. And they need to know that they're seen. And I think, and I know you will know this better than I do because you work in this population, but with kiddos too, is like, sometimes we have no idea if the words that we're saying are landing on them. And I've experienced that in like counseling kids too. And I remember a mentor telling me of like, just trust, like they're hearing, they're listening, they're taking it in. And you really never know what impact you're going to be making. So being really cognizant of your words and knowing your presence does make a difference, even if they don't say anything. Mm-hmm. Because you know, Jazzy will tell you that she does remember, you know, a lot of people's judgments of what they said to her. And she does remember a few people trying to reach out and in times where she would turn away out of discomfort and things. So it's like it's taken in, right? Everything is seen, I think, and everything's known. So that discomfort of, oh my God, am I going to say the right thing? There is no right thing. Mm-hmm. So one thing I would say of like, if you could, and if any of us could avoid, and this probably goes without saying, but I have unfortunately heard and experienced and received so many times where somebody is trying to resonate and say, oh yeah, like I knew somebody who had cancer once, and then proceeds to say, and they died.
Right. And oh my gosh.
It is shocking. It actually just happened to me this week with a very caring individual who was, you know, asking me a bit about my health history. And then they said, oh, well, I knew somebody who had cancer, that cancer, they died. And then they proceeded to tell me another person. And it's, I have no problem talking about death and dying. That's actually, sure, you know, the wheelhouse. But it's, I think that human hunger to try and connect, ooh, hey, I know something about that. But we just need to take a pause and a breath and think about, okay, what's my intention here? My intention is to connect. How's it going to land on this child or adult if the way I'm trying to connect with them is maybe telling them the one thing that they're probably scared a lot about? And I'm not really saying that we never talk about that. That's not a no-go zone. It's just I don't think that that's the way we connect. So that would probably be my one little caveat of being aware. But the other thing is like, so there's no right way of what to say, but just even the simplest thing of really treating each person like they're going through something. That was one of my participants said. She described it. She said, don't treat them like the well sibling, like somebody whose sibling is going through something. Treat them as somebody who is going through their own experience and ask them, how are they doing? Not always asking about the sick sibling. How are they doing? You know, it's not always, how's Genevieve? It's like, how's Jasmine?
Mm-hmm. And recognizing that in itself is an experience. And I think sometimes people are collecting dots and information and trying to make their own meaning of it. And I think your point about being really cognizant of who this is landing on, when you take a pause and think about what that intent is it to collect information or is it to be there for somebody else? And I think that distinction is really important too, because I think for some people it can be about just getting the information because that's just the default, you know. Again, it comes I think back to that roadmap piece around grief and loss and just not knowing what to do. So you start talking and you start saying things and away you go, right? So I just think that piece about really sort of being mindful of where your message lands is really important and how that might resonate with them. So not necessarily needing to have that deep connection through your shared experience, which may be far-fetched and totally irrelevant and not at all helpful to their state of mind. So really interesting. So if you were to sort of recommend that someone say something, is there any sort of, I mean, again, there's no right answer, but is there any guide that you could give to a teacher or a coach or someone that might help them start that conversation or that could at least send the message that I'm here with you. I care about you. You matter.
Exactly. That's exactly it. That's so you got it. Because like we toyed around with so many different titles for my thesis. At one point it was like, what about me? Ask me or include me, that whole piece. And then I came around to the real like affirmative statement of siblings, you matter. So I think what you said was really beautiful, right? And just, I think it's as simple as, and I found this continually in my work for the support people I support, along with the person diagnosed with cancer, is like just letting them know they matter and that you're there for them. And however you can help, you're a listening, safe place. And just remembering to treat them not as like the brother or sister or sibling of a kid who has cancer, treat them as their own individual person. Not that we're going to skirt around the fact that there's cancer in the family. I think it's good to have open dialogue about it and discuss with the parents too how much that child wants to be involved in the discussion, because, you know, one of the participants in my study talked about how in their classroom, like I told that previous story, in their classroom, the classroom was totally involved. They had an open dialogue. The well sibling was engaged in that. Another sibling told the story of being away, supporting their sibling through treatment, and came back to the classroom, and then everybody knew. Mm. Everyone knew that they'd been away because their sibling had cancer, and it was this whole taboo, shh, don't really talk about it, but they knew, everybody knew. And then they were getting pitying looks and feeling sorry for them, and they felt so angry and weirdly left out, but everyone knew their business. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really asking and seeing the child, the youth, as, you know, they have a right to actually be making choices about how their classroom is involved in the information. I think it's really important to include the teacher in the discussion so they can obviously have some empathy and understanding, you know, if things are changing in the child, and then involve, you know, if it's possible, to have a discussion between the parent, the sibling, and the teacher about what they want support in the classroom to look like, and just letting them know that you're there for them and you see them. And obviously this, I'm really focusing because my research was around the well sibling. But I would say, you know, for the sick sibling, I feel like there's so much more resource and discussion about how to support the sick sibling. And that's understandable, obviously, because that's where the focus has generally been with research. So that's why I'm not speaking to that part as much.
Yes. Yeah. No, and I think that's a really valuable piece, is just to remember to see that the well sibling and really, really hold space for them within that process. If we could switch gears a little bit, I'd love to dig in a little bit to your work in supporting people who have lived through cancer or are currently living through cancer. Yep. And I'd love to explore some of the programs that you develop and deliver for Inspire Health and Rise Health centers to support these individuals. And I'm guessing, and I'm making huge assumptions here, but I'm guessing that some of your work has to do with resiliency and reframing and sort of this ability to take adversity and, like you said, sort of find the meaning in it. So can you speak to that a little bit, or just kind of direct me on a different path if I'm way off base?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the most important thing for me is just meeting people wherever they're at. So there will be people who have a cancer diagnosis and for sure they feel like, wow, okay, my eyes are open and I want to make meaning in my life and I want to soak up however many days I have. And there will be other people who do not feel that way and feel pretty robbed of their life, of their health, of their well-being, all of those pieces. So it's, for me, the most important thing is just to meet people wherever they're at and hold space. And I love working for Inspire Health because it is really trying to find ways to support people to take charge in their own health and really become an active participant in their own health, wherever and at whatever stage of diagnosis they are at. So on the team, we have general practitioner doctors, we have dietitian nutritionists, exercise therapists, and then myself. We have clinical counselors as well on the team, and we're based in Vancouver, Kelowna, and then as well here in Victoria where I work. And I was fortunate enough to actually go through Inspire Health's programs way back in 2001 when I had cancer. So what I really love about working at Inspire Health is we're really about meeting patients wherever they are at and whatever stage of their diagnosis they are at, and their family members as well. And helping people to find their authentic way too of facing their illness. Like, some people really want to take charge of their health by getting engaged in nutrition and exercise and those kinds of pieces. And other people want to look at, you know, more of the emotional impact of the diagnosis, but then maybe stuff that was going on beforehand and really trying to look at stress management and stress reduction. And one of the things, you know, I think that is a misnomer in the cancer experience sometimes is that really like positivity overkill mindset that, oh, just be positive. You'll get through this. You're a fighter. Mm-hmm. You're gonna, you know, kick cancer's ass, you know, F-U-C-K, cancer, mm-hmm. all that kind of thing. But then there's some people who are like, I'm really angry, or I'm really sad, or I'm really scared. And then they feel like there's no space for that because they're supposed to be positive. And other people are going to say, hey, you know, don't let it get you down. You got to get through this. And I really, really believe that we have to meet people wherever they are at, and that we can't genuinely step into the light and find, you know, the possibility or the learning through difficulty without honoring this is really hard or this is really scary. And that was my own personal, I think, journey with my cancer experience as well, is like there was a lot of positivity and holding on to hope and holding on to light. But there was also space for this is really scary and this really sucks and I'm 18 and this isn't what I want to do. And so how do we hold the darkness with the light? And I think that that's a really important piece. And what I really like about Inspire Health is really wanting to meet people wherever they're at. So some of the things that I do on the team, obviously I'm a clinical counselor, so I have the privilege of sitting down with people and their loved ones to talk about how they are doing and how their relationships are doing and how I can support them through whatever is coming up for them and processing the different emotions and thoughts and feelings that come with a cancer diagnosis and beyond, because that's a huge piece of it too, is that after a cancer diagnosis, everyone's like, yippee, you're done, or like mm-hmm. after the treatment's done. And that often actually what we find is that people have a much harder time after treatment is completed than they did going through treatment, because in treatment you go here, you go there, you do this, you do that, and it's like go. Okay, I'm just gonna get through this. And then afterwards it's like, oh, what do I do now?
That's really profound, and I think I really appreciate the way that you've talked to that. And I think what comes to mind too is this sense of the expectations that we come into life with sometimes. And some of those expectations are imposed upon us by ourselves, by the media, by our families, by all of these values. And it sounds as though sometimes that's what is at the crux of the struggle with yep. sort of this positivity piece, is this sort of tension between the reality and the expectation of exactly. what is happening, you know, or what should yeah, be happening.
Exactly. Yeah, well said.
Yeah, so that's interesting, and I just think that's a, and I mean in some respects you could apply that to many different types of adversity.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, which is really interesting. So I appreciate you saying that, because I think people need to hear that going through an experience like, or living through cancer is not going to be the same experience for everyone. And people will nope. look at it in different ways. And because you process it in one way does not mean that there's any less value or more value. And I think sometimes we like to sort of slap labels or whatever on the way that people are processing grief or any kind of emotion, really, too much, too little, you know? So
Yeah. Like there's one right way to do it. And, you know, anybody who knows me will say like, Genevieve's an incredibly positive person. So it's sometimes surprising for people to hear me really say that of like, no, like, yes, I am very positive. And I believe in holding on to, you know, the light, and what are we hopeful for? And what do we love? And what makes us come alive? And also, what fucking sucks? And what do you feel angry about? I don't know if I can say the F word.
You sure can. Yeah.
You know, and that equally surprises people. And it's like, and how do we talk about all of those other uncomfortable, difficult emotions? But that's the grit, you know, and like that Thich Nhat Hanh quote of like, no mud, no lotus. Like they come together. We need both of them. And it's like, you know, the dark, no darkness without the light. And, I think that's really important for people to know, because it's, we have learning how to be with it. And, you know, I think you asked me at some point just about like, even going back to the other things that we were talking about, is how do we be with one another and how do we be with ourselves? But I think, you know, for myself, I even just did it. It's about taking a breath to slow down and create a bit of a space and a bit of a pause so that we can find ways to respond rather than react.
Yes, I think that's really profound. I want to dig a little deeper into this this concept of being kinder to ourselves. So going beyond and sort of defining this idea of kindness in my own, for me, kindness isn't this kindergarten variety of rainbows and butterflies and surface kindness. It's really about seeing yourself, being reflective, honoring all of you, the light, the darkness, all of it. So how, or do you have any guiding practices or principles that help you to practice kindness for yourself?
I think, you know, one of my favorite quotes about kindness is, or actually I think it's self-compassion, but I see self-compassion and kindness towards myself as a very, you know, similar thing. And that is, if my compassion for others and my kindness for others doesn't include myself, then it isn't true kindness. It isn't true compassion. So it's considering, it's not me first. It's just me too in all of this. So in considering how I can be kinder to others, it's being aware of the impact on myself. Cause quite frankly, I love random acts of kindness, and being kind to others fills my cup on the daily. And so that, you know, idea, I think, of complete selflessness and kindness, I don't think actually really exists, like, because it feels good to give.
Yes.
And we need to be mindful of also, you know, that we're giving from not an empty cup, and aware of how it impacts us. And so self-kindness also is about being, you know, really, really honest with ourselves. On good days, that's a lot easier, right? when I'm talking with Morgan and the podcast and I'm feeling good about what I'm saying, then all of a sudden when I lose my stream of thought and I think I'm rambling.
No.
But that, you know, the difference, right, is like, how do I be kind to myself regardless?
Yes.
Right? And I think that's about being honest and questioning what it is that I really value about myself. And can I, you know, am I only valuing my performance, or am I valuing myself as a human being regardless of how well I perform at something or how well I do in the day? And so being able, you know, kindness to me also is like, on the days that are like pretty difficult, how do I take care of myself? And on the days that are lukewarm, and that's where I notice people kind of really struggling, is sometimes on the in-between days, like days that are kind of just like vanilla pudding, like,
yes,
vanilla pudding days that are like, yeah, this isn't the most delicious day, but it's not terrible. It's just kind of a day. And can we be okay with that?
I love it. I think that's so great. And I think, you know what, this reminds me of something that you brought up to me once, the difference between perfectionism and healthy striving. And I think that piece kind of works itself in. Did you want to talk about that briefly?
Sure. And I get that from good old Brené Brown. She, I think, has been a huge inspiration for me. But
me too.
So I just, like, as she has defined it, as I understand it, perfectionism is like, what will everybody else think? And healthy striving is like, what feels good to me? Mm-hmm. So it's not that I stop trying or doing my best. I love that too. I love that distinction. So a way of being kind to ourselves is getting over this whole idea like, oh, I'm trying. Like, I don't actually watch Star Wars, but I really love the Yoda quote of like, do or do not, there is no try.
Yes.
Like, we are doing it or we're not doing it. And someone else offered to me of like, it's doing your best. No matter what we do, we're doing our best. Even, and this was wisdom my mom offered me of like, and this is self-kindness really in a nutshell, is like on those days that it's a rough day and you kind of check in and you're like, I just feel kind of, it's a rough day. I feel like, I mean, like I'm going to be a 3 out of 10 today. And then just be your best 3 out of 10 and like pat yourself on the back for showing up and being your best 3 out of 10, because your best 3 out of 10 might be someone else's 10 out of 10. And not that it's all a big game of comparison. It's just being aware of all we can do is our best. So
yes,
to me, that's what healthy striving is. Do my best and then leave the rest, because I've made my best effort and I've been gentle to myself. And that's been a crucial piece in my health and my awareness of my body's ability, which ebbs and flows. Like I am aware my body is mortal and at times she has, I refer to my body as third person.
Like, I love it.
It has reminded me, and she has said, hey, you got to slow down. And sometimes that bums me out because I just want to go, 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 go. And I had to slow down and make my best effort at a two or a three and be okay with that and be grateful. For me personally, I'm just grateful that I'm alive and I'm thriving and allowed to continue living and being here, not loud, but like the privilege of being alive, right? And to thrive as a two or a three or a six. And sometimes I'm a 10 and yippee,
yes.
Be my best 10. And that's to me like the difference, you know, perfectionism is like, nope, 10 out of 10. And 10 out of 10 usually is somebody else's set 10 out of 10 that might be completely impossible for me to achieve.
I love, you're such a beautiful human being. I love that. And I think that's such an important thing for teachers to hear, because I think a lot of us tend to be sometimes either recovering perfectionists or just right knee deep in it. And so mm-hmm. this idea of healthy striving for yourself to do your best, and also this two out of three or three out of three, if you don't accept where you are, then you downgrade yourself to like a one out of 10, right? So out of 10, I meant, but
I was with you.
Yeah. So I think that that's a really important message, because you can just keep going downward. Right. And so that's an important piece.
Yeah. And I think, cause like there's something you had mentioned in another conversation we were having just about this, like, and I know, I feel like there's this movement in the schools now, and at least like in bringing some mindfulness about being okay to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. So a perfectionist does not make mistakes. And if they do, like, the world is over. Whereas healthy striving and like from that growth mentality sees mistakes as an opportunity to grow and learn and okay. And to maybe even admit, ooh, yeah, maybe I made a mistake. And then maybe we have to learn to apologize for that too, which I think sometimes as human beings, we do a not very good job of apologizing and taking personal responsibility. And I think that that takes a lot of self-love, self-kindness to admit I've made a mistake, I've done something wrong, and it's okay. Can you please forgive me?
And owning that.
Yeah. It takes a lot of love and I think kindness towards ourselves to be okay to admit that.
I love it. So before we get to our rapid fire question, there were two things I think I wanted to talk about. You had a story about your niece. Did you want to share that?
Oh yeah. Okay. That fits in really nicely to perfectionism, healthy striving. So I have the privilege of being an auntie to three lovely nieces, and now so many nieces actually, because I just got married. I have four lovely nieces, and I think I have five nephews now. But anyways, one of my little nieces is like quite a magical human, and I was with her last weekend, and she was telling me about sports day is tomorrow on Monday, and she was so excited, and she's telling me she's a great runner, and I was so excited for her, and she said, yeah, last time at sports day I came in 45th place. I did so good. And I was like, oh, okay. Like I was, you know, excited. And then she's like, and then we had another one and I came in 27th place. And she's like so excited about it. And she's like, so Auntie Jen, you know what? I think I'm going to do better. I'm going to do better, even better. You know, tomorrow, I hope I come in. And of course I'm thinking like, I don't know, like, oh, second place, third place. She's like, I hope I come in 23rd place.
I know,
and I was like, oh, you're so wise, right? Like to just, I don't know, set. Yeah, she's doing her best, and it's like within reach, and it's, I don't even know how she ended up doing. I didn't actually follow up and find out, because it doesn't really matter, right? Like she just knows that she's trying her best, I thought it was such a beautiful example, right, of just being okay, being part of the pack, and things are getting better, but she's having fun, so. She's a good little teacher.
I love that. And I can just see her little face just running up with a big smile. That's so cute. So we're both fans of Pema Chodron. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, I just want to wrap it up with her quote and maybe your reflection on the concept of failure. So she has a passage in her book that I just recently read, Fail Again, Fail Better. So she says, so fail again, fail better. Get good at holding the rawness of vulnerability in your heart. Welcome the unwelcome. She said her teacher explained to her as she hit her rock bottom. So the waves keep coming and you keep cultivating your courage and bravery and sense of humor to relate to the situation of the waves. And you keep getting up and going forward. So can you talk a little bit about your perspective on what you think failure is and how kindness kind of relates to that?
That's so beautiful. I think it's probably just that exact piece that she's saying is how we get up again and again, and we're willing to try, because being human, and like I say this so often with people I'm sitting with, or they say it to me, is like, this hurts. Right. And it's painful and it's vulnerable to love. And that's, I think, the hugest thing, right, is like, that's painful in a cancer diagnosis or in any of our dynamics with relationships. When we love, we also feel pain because those relationships get hurt or they change, or maybe there's death and dying. And the thing is, if we don't love, then we don't feel pain. And if we don't try, then we don't fail. Or we don't do our best, then we don't fail in experiencing that pain. So how we can be okay with being with pain, and we have to be willing to put ourselves out there, and being willing to get up and to try again, and being willing to get up and to try again, and be gentle with ourselves each time. And really, I think also honor and celebrate the resilience that it takes to get up and to try again.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's at the heart of what I believe in. And I know that in the work that you do, that's sort of the message that you're able to provide people, is and that safe place to within which to do that. So I think you're a gift. And I think the people that you work with are incredibly, incredibly lucky to have you.
And I would say I'm just like, I am so privileged to get to do the work that I do, and all the different human beings that I have the honor of sitting with. I'm inspired by them, and I learn from them. So it's a very much a privilege to get to sit with people.
Could you define what kindness means to you?
Kindness is love.
What book or books have you gifted most often to people?
Broken Open: How Difficult Times Help Us Grow. That is by Elizabeth Lesser.
What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective? And in terms of effective, I think I mean in order to be there for somebody who is going through adversity.
Curiosity and compassion.
Would you say that differs if we were to talk about the skill or superpower that a principal needs to have for his or her staff and students?
Creativity.
What message or quote would you print on one of those quote cups that are sold in big bookstores that would be read by millions of people?
Normal day, let me be aware of the treasure you are. Let me learn from you, love you, bless you before you depart. Let me not pass you by in quest of some rare and perfect tomorrow. That's by Mary Jean Iron.
Oh man, that's beautiful. That's a really, really profound one. I love that. I don't think I've ever heard that one before. Thank you. I think that's a good way to leave off. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close?
I just think you're a really neat human, Morgan. And I really do. I admire what you're doing. And I think kindness wins. And I know that you alluded to this, but that quote of everyone we know is fighting a battle we know nothing about. So be kind always. There's always an opportunity to be kind.
I agree wholeheartedly. Thank you so much, Jen, for sharing your story and for being vulnerable and for all of your wisdom. I know that a lot of people will be really blessed to hear your message. So thank you.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.